Well, we are hoping that we are back on the air. I apologize for that. A little bit of a short in the microphone. Just what you need as you get ready to go on the air. I apologize again for that. This is Scott Stevens, and you're listening to a slightly abridged version of the Jesus Factor. And, you know, it's funny how radio works like that. You think you have plenty of time, and in radio, and those out there who have been on the air before know that a minute is actually a long time in radio. That's why we get hung up about dead air and things like that. And with their 10 minutes left before the broadcast, everything seemed to be working perfectly. And then all of a sudden I realized I had something of a problem with the microphone, which I thought I had resolved as we came up on the air. And as our theme song teaches us, to everything, there is a season. And we know, in accordance with the Word of God, that all things work together for good to them that are the love the Lord, for those that are the called according to His purpose. And it's been mentioned on the network more than once today that the Lord can use anything to reach those that He is getting a message to. And it's something we've been talking about for a while here on the Jesus Factor, particularly during the time that Jesus walked the earth, how things were set up and how the stage was set for His incarnation as a man. And here in the Jesus Factor, we believe, whether it's Judging Amy, as Sue talked about in the broadcast before ours, or whether it's old-time rock and roll or contemporary news and the historical accounts that we provide here on the Factor, that it is an absolute truth that the Lord is well able to deal with every situation and to provide truth to those who want it in every situation. And we've talked here on the Jesus Factor before about the ministry of the space-time continuum. God operates outside the box of space and time. It's why His hand prevails over all things, and why in the various situations in history we can see His intervention clearly when we are His. Of course, to the unregenerate man, the things that take place in history are just a disjointed series of events. Most of the unregenerate historical research out there verifies that there are patterns that do seem to repeat themselves throughout history. And rather than place the appropriate reasoning behind those repeating patterns, what the people generally do is just think that it's some kind of a coincidence, or that man is somehow a little silly because he repeats the same mistakes over and over again. The idea that man is a creature born 100% steeped in sin is something that is missed by the unregenerate man, and it is missed entirely that God intervenes in everyone's life one way or another in an effort to redeem them and draw them closer to Him. And of course, we played in the interim of our distress the U.S. blues out there. And we're going to do a little bit of a United States update. There's a lot going on in the United States that would lead even the most stalwart Obama supporter to recognize that President Obama and his administration are in a good deal of trouble presently. And there is a hit parade of commentaries out there by a number of different well-known opposers of Obama's administration that have made comments about the events that are going on. Rand Paul was one of them. Senator Rand Paul said yesterday that it's so tragic that it's almost humorous that the former head of the Internal Revenue Service Department involved in the targeting of conservative groups is now running the agency's unit charged with implementing Obamacare. Is that a cockeyed system of justice, if we can call it that? System of injustice, unjust, unregenerate men determining the fate in terms of how they are to receive care from doctors. Paul continued and said, it's just hard for me to believe. Most of us not only want people fired who abuse their power, some of them should probably be imprisoned. And instead, we find out that they're being promoted. This is how things go in a world steeped in sin. Paul said we're really quite unhappy, and really the president hasn't quite gotten this. He added that whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, nobody wants the government so powerful that they can use that power to abuse their political opponents. Don't believe that for a minute, though. There are people out there who are looking to establish a powerful enough government that it can monitor and control everyone's behavior. Those that think they are above the law and believe themselves qualified to make choices determining your future and mine. These are people who want to play God. They are antichrist by nature. And there are an entire hall of fame of these people throughout history. Obamacare has 47 separate provisions that require IRS involvement. Does that concern anyone out here that an administration that is clearly not above targeting its opponents using the power of the IRS, a financial power, one that is able without a court ruling to make the lives of those that it investigates quite difficult? Or those in this ministry that have already felt the hand of the IRS on their affairs. The IRS is charged with administering Obamacare's required purchase of health coverage and checking whether millions of Americans are in compliance. They're going to find out that a lot of people are upset by this. You think so? In today's world? You think it's going to matter much as long as when you go to the doctor you get what you want? Most people will not care, and that's the problem. People don't care if their flesh is ministered to and made comfortable, what the source of that comfort is. And it is a problem in an unregenerate world. It's a problem for Christians, those of us that believe God's struggle with doing wrong things to try and accomplish goals that we have in mind. Paul said that Friday's testimony of the ousted IRS acting commissioner Stephen Miller, in which he told the congressional committee that foolish mistakes were made by people trying to be more efficient, was not credible. Most of the people involved in that hearing thought that his testimony was entirely ludicrous. Entirely ludicrous. Paul also said that some Americans were targeted simply for showing their concern about the direction of government and showing opposition to government policies. If you don't believe this, if you don't believe that you can be targeted, okay, stick around for a little bit, because almost everything, almost every human behavior is coming in one way or another under the control and monitoring of the United States government, and at some point or another, one that will oversee it. With all the power of the commander-in-chief, what we hope is that we can trust that man or woman to restrain himself from abusing that power, Paul said. We have a lot of laws in place to try and restrain it, but you also need a president who would restrain himself and not abuse the power. This is a tremendous issue throughout our account of history here on the Jesus Factor. We find that in the United States, a government was set up with the idea of restraining man in his sinful nature. But that as time has gone on, and particularly in the last 75 or 80 years, those restraints have been almost entirely removed. The restraints of the Constitution, it was not a document set up to make government a blessing to you. It was a document set up to make government stay out of your way. And sadly, because of the legions of unregenerate men, and perhaps some regenerate men that have been carried along with the tide. We now find ourselves in a situation where the government can and will monitor and restrain or support nearly every human behavior. Ben Stein is another guy who's a well-known commentator, columnist, and he's a Jewish guy that was involved with the Nixon administration back during the time when Nixon was under the gun for the Watergate scandal. Stein said Saturday that Obama's administration is guilty of more than incompetence in the case of the Benghazi attack that resulted in the deaths of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. This is another element of the abuse of power, the ongoing abuses of power by this administration, the cover-ups, and the media manipulation, and the fact that so many of today's mainline media personalities supported Mr. Obama makes it extraordinarily tough for them to come to the place where they realize that perhaps they were wrong. Ben Stein says that Benghazi was outright malfeasance, lying, a criminal cover-up. A number of commentators have attempted to draw comparisons between Nixon's Watergate, which resulted in his resignation from the presidency, and Obama's triple dish of scandals now facing his administration. Stein accused Obama of lying to investigators in the 8 months since the September 11th attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Libya. A number of prominent Republicans, including Vice President Dick Cheney, have charged that senior Obama officials attempted a cover-up of the facts and that an alleged Al-Qaeda-affiliated group was responsible for the attack and that this was done to prevent this particular tragedy from affecting President Obama's re-election bid. Mix this up with the IRS's interference with those politically active individuals that would come against Obama and his campaign, and you have an admixture of serious abuses of power. Serious abuses of power. And while we don't yet see anyone other than those such as Stein and Paul, those that are most notably on the right of President Obama politically, I don't see anyone out there putting the frank seriousness of the administration's misdeeds in clear terms. We do expect that that may be the case as time goes on. We have a lot of issues going on in the United States and around the world, that particularly the issue of our financial hobbling because of incessant borrowing over the last 50 or 60 years that has culminated in the last 10 years of extraordinary measures by central bankers to prop up the United States economy and the economies of other governments of the world, that is. The Treasury Department reported last week, as the financial news tightens, that it is employing special measures, limiting spending so that the federal government can keep paying its bills after the nation reached its borrowing limit last week. Of course, this happens every once in a while with that debt clock ticking ever more rapidly. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew told Congress on Friday that he was ready to start the standard set of extraordinary measures. Treasury on Friday stopped issuing state and local government series securities, which state and local governments use to refund municipal bond deals. Treasury can also stop new investments in federal employee retirement funds and in the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which buys and sells foreign currencies. The moves are expected to free billions of dollars the government can use to pay its bills. At the beginning of the year, Congress suspended the nation's $16.4 trillion borrowing limit until May 19th. The limit was automatically boosted to cover whatever borrowing the Treasury incurred during the period. So the limit jumped by about $300 billion to $16.7 trillion. Lou said in a letter to Congress that it is likely that it has until shortly after Labor Day to raise the borrowing debt cap before the nation's finances reach a damaging default. What you have here is something that we were counseled from the beginning in this country to avoid. Bankers controlling the destiny of the United States. It has been a relationship that has been built up since the establishment of the Federal Reserve System that has allowed the United States as a nation and we as a people to borrow from the future. What happens ultimately if you borrow too much from the future is that any future good that can be accessed monetarily disappears. Disappears. And that is, in our view here at the Jesus Factor, where we have allowed ourselves to come as a nation. There are only a handful of options. Most of them are not pretty, that might enable us to extract ourselves from this ever-growing debt that has hobbled us as a country. All of them would present extraordinary discomfort for every American. And as a country, we no longer have the will, the courage, and the faith to endure the kinds of difficulties that this future that we have borrowed from has presented to us. All of us out here that are Christians should continue to pray for this government that somehow or another the Lord in His grace and wisdom and power can deliver us from our own foolishness. And this, of course, is what true Christianity is all about. At the end of the day, every true Christian and every organization will come under the judgment of God. And the idea that the only possible answer is to be found on our knees before Jesus has always been the truth.
In the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that, of course, is the Israel Update song here on the Jesus Factor. We've got still a number of things going on there. If you hadn't guessed already, I can tell you that the speed at which things are occurring in the Middle East has increased dramatically in the last several weeks. You see, when events take place at a pace that people are able to respond to them thoughtfully, there is much less likelihood that errors of judgment will be made on behalf of any of the parties. What has happened in the last year, as a function of Iranian, Russian, Chinese, Korean, and other collaboration, has allowed certain elements of Al-Qaeda and other Islamist terror organizations to gain control of a number of troubling materials. Make no mistake about it, as things continue to move more quickly in the Middle East, the likelihood of such an organization coming into possession of some form of bad juju that can be unleashed almost anywhere in the world increases dramatically. And the result of that, in a nation such as ours that is unprepared to make decisive moves, could be cataclysmic. The Sunday Times reports that Syria is deploying advanced Tishreen surface-to-surface missiles to strike Tel Aviv in case Israel launches another attack. The paper cites information obtained by reconnaissance satellites tracking Syrian forces without any other source. Syria's deputy foreign minister, Fasil Maqdad, said in a broadcast Thursday that on May 16th, that if Israel again attacked Syria, it would face an immediate and painful response. Asked if he realized that his words meant war between Israel and Syria, Maqdad replied, "So what? So there'll be war." What some people in the United States and perhaps others around the world don't seem to get is that there are forces in the Middle East that want to unleash a war. They want to unleash a war. Since January, Israel has conducted 3 airstrikes in Syria targeting shipments of Iranian weapons headed for transfer to Hezbollah. Hezbollah, of course, is an Islamist organization that has become predominant in the Syrian civil conflict. Many believe that Assad remaining in power in Syria is preferable to some of the factions that have begun to rear their ugly heads in that part of the world. And the fact that the Iranians are so eager and willing to help these various factions is one more thing that should tell our diplomats and politicians and military strategists that whether there is a plan afoot to deploy nuclear weapons made in Iran to some part of the globe at some distant time, whether there is a plan afoot to do such a thing, there is certainly interest in creating such a plan in Iran and among these Islamist forces, particularly those situated in the midst of this war in the Middle East. They are becoming more battle that could arise from the conflict in Syria and the alliances growing out of that conflict. The night before this report, on May 18th, Fox News aired footage appearing to show Israeli commandos inside Syria racing back on foot to Israeli territory. Without going into whether the two sets of Israeli officials were one and the same, their utterances are clearly making Israel's policymakers and defense leaders look muddled and uncertain, or worse, unable to think clearly about how to cope with the menace building up on the Syrian Golan. This could take the form of a Syrian war of attrition and or a Hezbollah offensive against Upper and Western Galilee. These are a set of events that are possibilities as the continuing tide of things continues unchecked over there. Now, I have been accused, the Jesus Factor and this broadcaster have been accused of being a warmonger. Nothing could be further from the truth. However, when you have a set of circumstances that suggests your enemies, people who have declared themselves openly as being hostile to your very life, are making moves that could at some point secure to them the means by which they might attack you, is it not less violent, potentially so, at any rate, to intervene in that situation before it becomes more difficult to control? At all events, the Syrian civil conflict appears ready and poised to spill over to one or more of its neighbors, starting with Israel, as a result of six factors. Now, here are the factors that are listed by the Israeli intelligence groups as being important. President Obama's inability to make up his mind on whether the U.S. should intervene militarily in Syria. That inability to make up his mind is coming from the people of this United States who are unprepared spiritually to declare one way or another what the right thing to do is in any difficult situation. The muddled nature of the thoughts in the head of our leader is a function not only of his spiritual condition, but the spiritual condition of the nation as a whole. The U.S. president's refusal to recognize that chemical weapons have already been used in Syria. His reaction to the file put before him in the White House Friday, May 17th, by Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, with evidence from physicians treating wounded Syrians, remained dismissive. The U.S. has seen evidence of chemical weapons being used in Syria, he said, adding, however, it is important to get more specific details about the alleged chemical attacks. This actually links to point number one, a lack of willingness to draw any clear line that both our allies and our enemies would be able to discern as one that would trigger action from these United States. This is a tactical blunder of epic proportions by a commander-in-chief. Certainly, such signals were sent during the Vietnam War and Korea. Less so in the Iraqi conflicts. But anyone who has studied war and its history recognizes that a lack of preparation in a moral and spiritual sense, a willingness to take a stand, or a lack thereof, can precipitate disastrous consequences. And this is what we have been talking about here with regard to our position in the Middle East for some time. The third point, following again in American footsteps, Israel failed to prevent Russia sending advanced S-30 anti-air and Yak Hunt anti-ship missiles to the Assad regime, both improved versions which were outfitted with sophisticated radar to improve their range and precision. When Netanyahu was challenged with failing in this mission in his May 14th trip to buttonhole Russian President Vladimir Putin in Sochi, he said only that he would travel wherever is needed to talk to whoever is needed to keep Israel safe and secure. So the deployment of Russian-made military equipment into this area, another element. And because Israel gets no clear signal from the United States as to what its position will be, Israel now vacillates in how it ought to respond to the growing menace on its borders. A list of strategic errors here in point four, which may turn out to be irreversible because they emanated from faulty assessments shared by Israel and the Obama administration of the strengths on the Syrian battlefield. To this day, The U.S., Israel, and Turkey cling to the belief that Assad's days are numbered and refuse to recognize the steady advances made by the Syrian army in its counteroffensive for dislodging the rebels from land they captured in more than 2 years of combat. Point five, the misreading of Syria's ruler's survivability is part and parcel of the omission by Obama, Netanyahu, and Erdogan to appreciate and counter two major strategic changes overtaking the region. They stood aside as Moscow, Tehran, and Hezbollah deepened their military commitments to Assad's fight for survival, starting with the arrival of Russian military personnel in Syria to man the sophisticated missiles supplied by Moscow until Syrian crews were instructed in their use. They didn't raise a finger to interfere with the almost daily Russian and Iranian airlifts to Syrian air bases of complete brigades of elite Hezbollah fighters and thousands of Iranian Basij militiamen who now control key war sectors. Every day that this goes on is a day that we have to plunge deeper into the conflict in order to stop it. And the leaders, even in Israel, don't seem able to recognize that such intervention by Russia, orchestrated in and for Islamist revolutionaries, is a signal that we must take seriously and have a determined and clear course of action to respond to. A war of attrition against Israel from the Golan would not be a new experience for either Damascus or Moscow. In 1974, from March to May, Syrian forces refusing to accept the defeat of their 1973 offensive against Israel launched a harsh war of attrition from the same enclave on the advice of their Soviet patron in what became known as the Little War. Syrian forces kept the Israeli Golan under heavy shelling barrages and tried repeatedly to capture Mount Hermon. The big secret of that short-lived conflict was the deployment by the Soviet Union of two Cuban armored brigades to the Golan against Israel, airlifted from Angola. All the same, Damascus was forced to accept a ceasefire on the Golan, which was observed from that day until the present. This time, the big difference is that Moscow can leave the heavy lifting for a limited war on Israel to Tehran and Hezbollah. They have declared a willingness, an eagerness, to make a war on Israel. They have set the stage, and now they begin to acquire the munitions and the military force necessary to issue a crushing blow to the nation of Israel, and every day that nothing is done that is decisive to stop this, the situation is a greater threat to Israel and to the United States. And with the kind of indecisiveness that our leaders here in the United States are displaying, it may be that the whole region could come to blows before we would recognize that we must play some role in stopping the momentum of the alliances that are building and the forces who are on the battlefield, whose leaders have declared their solemn hatred of Israel, Christianity, and the United States.
that's not the world I know inside. Everybody hides. You gotta talk.
Well, all right, a little bit of the light in your eyes there from Sheryl Crow. Now on to the historical portion of the Jesus Factor for today. I am your host, Scott Stevens, here on the Jesus Factor. You're listening to the Eagle Radio Network, and we've spent some time seeking to provide a picture of some depth of the political and philosophical and social state that Rome was in the time when Jesus and the apostles who were first called walked the earth. And we've spoken a lot about Rome and how things were there. Today ought to just about wrap up what was going on in Rome, and perhaps we will get around to some of how Luke's gospel speaks directly, and of course Acts speaks directly to the state of things in Rome at the time the gospel was preached there in the beginning of the church age. And in Rome, there was no principle of separation of church and state. During the period of the Republic, the same men who were elected public officials might also serve as augurs and pontiffs, priests, married, raised families, and led politically active lives. Julius Caesar, and of course this is long before the walk of our Lord as a man, but it is the roots of the kind of system that he ended up being plunged into, and the place, the social place, and the political place that the gospel was then preached in. And the reason we present this as being important is, look, the Lord doesn't leave details unmanaged. So much of what went on during the course of the lifetime of Jesus the man were things that had been set in motion hundreds and in some cases thousands of years before the word testifies from the beginning of the coming of the Lord. And so all of the ingredients to the, if you will, the baking of that cake had to be in place. And many of them began groundwork in a political and social sense, began to be laid for the passing of the gospel, the transmission of the word of God to the Gentiles, those that were outside the Jewish community. Now, Julius Caesar became Pontifex Maximus before he was elected to the council. The augurs read the will of the gods and supervised the marking of boundaries as a reflection of universal order, thus sanctioning Roman expansionism as a matter of divine destiny. If you're interested in knowing a modern country who embraced this doctrine, think of Britain during the period of colonization. The Roman triumph was at its core a religious procession in which the victorious general displayed his piety and his willingness to serve the public good by dedicating a portion of his spoils to the gods, especially Jupiter, who embodied just rule. As a result of the Punic Wars, which took place between 264 and 146 BC, when Rome struggled to establish itself as the dominant power, many new temples were built by magistrates in fulfillment of a vow to deity for assuring their military success. Roman religion was thus practical and contractual, based on the principle of I give that I might give. Oh, excuse me, I give that you might give, having to do with, of course, the leader giving that you, the Roman citizens, might give. Religion depended on knowledge and the correct practice of prayer, ritual, and sacrifice, not on faith or dogma, although Latin literature preserves learned speculation on the nature of the divine and its relation to human affairs. Even the most skeptical among Rome's intellectual elite, such as Cicero, who was an augur, saw religion as a source of social order. For ordinary Romans, religion was a part of daily life. Each home had a household shrine at which prayers and libations to the family's domestic deities were offered. Neighborhood shrines and sacred places, such as springs and groves, dotted the city. The Roman calendar was structured around religious observances. Women, slaves, and children all participated in a range of religious activities. Some public rituals could be conducted only by women, and women formed what is perhaps Rome's most famous priesthood, the state-supported Vestal Virgins, who tended Rome's sacred health for centuries, until disbanded under Christian domination. We will talk about that in a later broadcast, right? Because what ended up happening is the Vestal Virgins were transformed into what became monasteries, nunneries, that is, filled with women dedicated to the service of what became a Romanized form of Christianity. We've spoken of that in some length here on the Jesus Factor. And, of course, we will elaborate on the Vestal Virgins at a later time, but most listeners are aware of the church's slide after the conversion, so-called conversion of Constantine into idolatry. The Romans are known for the great number of deities they honored, a capacity that earned the mockery of early Christians. The presence of Greeks on the Italian peninsula from the beginning of the historical period influenced Roman culture, introducing some religious practices that became as fundamental as the cult of Apollo. The Romans looked for common ground between the major gods and those of the Greeks, adapting Greek myths and iconography for the Latin literature and Roman art. Etruscan religion was also a major influence, particularly on the practice of augury, since Rome had once been ruled by Etruscan kings. Imported mystery religions, which offered initiates salvation in the afterlife, were a matter of personal choice for an individual, practiced in addition to carrying on one's family's rites and participating in public religion. The mysteries, however, involved exclusive oaths and secrecy, conditions that conservative Romans viewed with suspicion as characteristic of magic, conspiracy, and subversive activity. Sporadic and sometimes brutal attempts were made to suppress religionists who seemed to threaten traditional morality and unity, as with the Senate's efforts to restrict the Bacchanals in 186 BC. Of course, the mystery religions made their way into Rome from both Egypt and ancient Greece and other nations that go as far back as Babylon. We have done some reporting on the mysteries and continue to speak of them here on The Factor. As the Romans extended their dominance throughout the Mediterranean world, their policy in general was to absorb the deities and cults of other peoples rather than to try and eradicate them. And we've spoken at length on this. This is why the Jews were allowed to maintain their temple worship. It was viewed by most Romans as a harmless exercise, as other religion was viewed by most Romans. And we'll get, as we move forward here today, to the philosophies that grounded most Romans in their way of thinking. One way that Rome incorporated diverse peoples was by supporting their religious heritage, building temples to local deities that framed their theology within the hierarchy of Roman religion. Inscriptions throughout the empire record the side-by-side worship of local and Roman deities, including dedications made by Romans to local gods. The height of the empire. By the height of the empire, numerous international deities were cultivated at Rome and had been carried to even the most remote provinces, among them Cybel, Isis, Epona, and gods of solar monism such as Mithras and Sol Invictus, found as far north as Roman Britain. Because Romans had never been obligated to cultivate one god or one cult only, religious tolerance was not an issue in the sense that it was for competing monotheistic systems. The monotheistic rigor of Judaism posed difficulties for Roman policy that led at times to compromise in the grand special exemptions, but sometimes to effectual conflict in the end. You know, the war broke out in around 70 AD between the Jews and the Romans, and that they utterly destroyed the temple at Jerusalem and that city. In the wake of the Republic's collapse, state religion had adapted to support the new regime of emperors. Augustus, the first Roman emperor, justified the novelty of one-man rule with a vast program of religious revivalism and reform. Public vows formerly made for the security of the Republic now were directed at the well-being of the emperor. So-called emperor worship expanded on a grand scale. The traditional Roman veneration and the ancestral dead and of the genius, the divine tutelary of every individual. The imperial cult became one of the major ways Rome advertised its presence in provinces and cultivated shared cultural identity and loyalty throughout the empire. Rejection of the state religion was tantamount to treason, as we have said here on several repeating broadcasts. Emperor worship was essentially mandatory. The idea that a lord came and preached another kingdom was all by itself treasonous to Rome. Early Christianity was believed to be a political and spiritual war against the ideology and spiritual nature of the Roman dictatorship. So, now we have a broad sense of how things were in Rome and the roots of some of the old pagan practices. One of the things that we find in God's Word were two particular schools of philosophy that are mentioned in Acts 17 as the Apostle Paul begins his sermon on Mars Hill. With those in attendance, he said, "Holy, given to idolatry." They believed all kinds of things. Two particular brands of idolatry are mentioned in Acts 17, the Stoics and the Epicureans. Our sense of all of this, by the way, is that there were a broad number, as history suggests, of ideologies and philosophies that were woven into the religious fabric of the day. It was a potpourri of ideas. It was one of the things that when you think of the wonder of God's power in coming forward and speaking the truth in the midst of a blizzard of lies, truth becomes more evident in such a blizzard. That seems a little counterintuitive, but it is absolutely so. Now, Stoicism was a school of Hellenistic philosophy. Hellenistic, of course, referring to the Greeks. Established in Athens by Zeno in the early 3rd century B.C. The Stoics taught that destructive emotions resulted from errors in judgment, and that a sage or a person of moral and intellectual perfection would not suffer such emotions. Stoics were concerned with the active relationship between cosmic determinism and human freedom, and the belief that it is virtuous to maintain a will that is in accord with nature. Because of this, the Stoics presented their philosophy as a way of life, and they thought that the best indication of an individual's philosophy was not what a person said, but how he behaved. Now, this is a set of ideas that embraced guys like Seneca and Epictetus, who emphasized that because virtue is sufficient for happiness, a sage was immune to misfortune. The belief is similar to the meaning of the phrase Stoic calm, though the phrase does not include the radical ethical Stoic views that only a sage can be considered truly free. This is an aspect of the mysteries as well, because all of these philosophies were woven into the mysteries, and they used the schools of philosophies to lure people into the practice of the various mystery religions that had been afoot from the time of Babel, perhaps longer. The other particular philosophic bent that is mentioned on Mars Hill is the Epicureans. The life of Epicurus is better known than any of his contemporaries, and he is of more of a personality than any other ancient philosopher, with the exception of Socrates. We spoke of him last week, and how Philo, a Jewish philosopher around at the time of Christ's walk, had embraced some of the philosophies, and how that had jaundiced his faith in Scripture. In 307 or 306 BC, Epicurus settled in Athens, where he bought a house with a garden. Here he gathered a group of disciples and taught them what he knows, what became known as the philosophy of the garden. Epicurus and his disciples formed a close-knit community, living a life of austere contentment in seclusion on his property. He admitted both women and slaves to his community. All right, now this Epicureanism, these ideas, Epicureanism and Stoicism, were at least in some way related, as you can see. And philosophy, as an internal practice, was something that the people did along with their religious idolatry. All right, and the groundwork that was laid in the minds of men by all of this wasn't lost on the Lord. And when the truth of the gospel and salvation by faith, because all of these things offer some form of salvation, but it was in the clear speaking of the gospel truth of salvation by faith in the work of the Messiah Jesus on the cross, that all of this stuff began to be broken down. And we'll have more on that, and how Luke's gospel and the Acts intertwined with the days, with the ideas of Roman philosophy and its religions, on next week's broadcast. Thank you all for sticking around and listening to this edition of the Jesus Factor.